This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Scientists have been working for decades to try to understand the underlying causes of schizophrenia. This week, more than 300 researchers from all around the world, including several at UNC Chapel Hill, published a study that identifies more than 100 genetic markers tied to a higher risk for schizophrenia. It's a big step forward in finding new ways to fight the disorder that at this point has no clear treatment. Patrick Sullivan is one of those researchers. He's a doctor at UNC School of Medicine and co-authored the study, and Patrick Sullivan joins us now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Give us an idea of what we found now. We've identified genetic markers, so tell us what you've done and what that means.
Sure. So there are several things that are distinguishing about this study. It represents about 7 years of work by a huge international team. There are 300 authors to the paper. People have come together in a way that we've never done before. And it frankly represents probably the largest experiment we've ever done in psychiatry. As part of this, given the scale and the scope, we were able to push the knowledge base further than we've ever had before. The previous study that had identified 22 loci for schizophrenia came out about a year ago, and now we've sort of bumped that up by about a factor of five.
So what does that mean, that you've identified risk factors? This doesn't determine that you will have schizophrenia. You've identified risk factors.
Exactly. What it looks like happens at the genetic basis is that people inherit a probability of developing schizophrenia. Nothing we found yet in any study has been deterministic. In other words, if you have it, you get schizophrenia, and if you don't, you don't, which makes it a rather different thing than many other genetic disorders that people are familiar with, where the genetic variant actually does determine whether or not you get it. Here, it's risk and it's probability. And our study, of course, like all good science, has pushed things further, but it raises a whole bunch of new questions.
Well, before we get into some of those very good questions raised by the study, we should remind ourselves of what schizophrenia is. We might think we know what it is, but how would you describe this disorder?
Sure. So schizophrenia is a very severe, often very severe mental illness that's characterized by delusions, hallucinations, and a constellation of cognitive changes. So people have a characteristic set of deficits in how they think and how they process information. Onset is typically in the late teens, early 20s, a bit earlier in men, a bit later in women. For many people, it's a chronic relapsing remitting course, even with good treatment. For many other people, though, it can be something where they have it for a period of time, but then they get better almost spontaneously.
How is it treated?
Sure. There's a number of effective treatments for schizophrenia. Optimal treatment is a combination of a good personal relationship with a psychiatrist, often with an ancillary therapist. There's a bunch of cognitive steps and various things that can be done. But for many people, medication is key. There's a couple of a dozen FDA-approved medications that are clearly efficacious for schizophrenia. And one of the motivations for our study is that none of these treatments are where we want them to be right now. They tend to be more, for many people, more palliative than curative. And we certainly want to actually try to find things that can actually make life better for a lot more people.
Is there anything in your research and what you've determined now by identifying these genes that could lead to that?
Absolutely. So one of the things that was an amazing finding in this study is the molecular target of all approved antipsychotics was actually one of the things we found, which certainly indicates that we're going in the right direction. There was another class of receptor targets that I think a lot of the pharmaceutical people are really interested in because these may be novel ways to look at schizophrenia.
What is the approach medically that you would take? Are you trying to sort of disable the effect of this gene, or are we trying to correct the gene?
That's a great question. The short answer is we don't know. The longer answer, however, is that the study that we did that was published a couple days ago and a new study that actually is in the works right now is going to help us dial in much better into the fundamental biology, the neurobiology of schizophrenia. That's the golden ring that we need to find.
Because I'm making the assumption, and maybe I should ask the question first, that that what we're finding is a defect in the gene. I mean, am I right about that? That it's not working the way it does in the normal in the rest of the population?
I think I'd tweak that a little bit. I think what's going on, the best of our knowledge right now, is that there's a network, a pattern of genes. And it's not any one part of the pattern. It's actually the whole thing. And it may be that this network is too inflexible or too flexible. Or if you get hit, that this gets hit with some external influence at the wrong point in time, it tips things over. And if we can identify what that network is, then we can bring some of the great tools that our pharmacology colleagues have in Bayer to really figure out, okay, how can we coax that from where it is right now back into normalcy?
All right. So if you do more of this research, you refine your answers, it might lead to better treatment. How about diagnosis? Is there anything in this that indicates we might someday have a test for schizophrenia?
And I would say that at this point in time, no. There is no reason to think that this will lead to a good diagnostic test. Certainly nothing that a parent should think about when they're trying to have a child. As it turns out, one of the implications of our work, Frank, is that all of us actually carry a lot of these variants. And the effects are very subtle. And it may be, in fact, that it's the accumulation of hundreds of different ones which actually ends up being the risk factor, not just having any single one. That means that any kind of test is going to be very difficult at the very start. In addition, one of the things we've known for decades is that identical twins, if one twin has schizophrenia, the risk to the co-twin, the genetically identical individual, is only 50-50. And that tells us right there that any test is going to have a really, really hard time. In fact, we'll probably fail.
Wow. That's pretty – you're talking about identical twins
exactly, right? Yes. Now.
And only a 50-50 chance if one has it. That the other will. So testing, as you suggest right now, is not sort of the result of your research. But I do want to ask the question, push it a little further. Do we see indications of these variants in the parents, or do we have to wait and test the individual?
That's another great question, Frank. So as it turns out, if a person has a lot of these particular variants, then the chances are their relatives also have them too. But even in that instance, the vast majority of people with schizophrenia do not have a family history. They do not have another immediate relative or even a more distant relative with schizophrenia. For most people, it tends to occur once in a family. And the ones that have a lot of people tend to have a lot more of a burden of these common variants than other people do.
We're talking about new research into the genetic factors of schizophrenia on the state of things. My guest is Dr. Patrick Sullivan of UNC School of Medicine, co-author of a recent study that increased the number of genes we now see implicated in schizophrenia. It's a frustrating disease. We've talked about the genetic factors, but there are environmental factors as well, right?
Absolutely. And this is we call schizophrenia a complex trait, where why a person has it is going to be an individual mix of what they've inherited from their parents, as well as the environmental exposures they're subject to, the decisions they make, the things they do and do not do. And certainly bad luck can be part of it too. As it turns out, given current technologies, it's relatively easier to screen the genome, all of the DNA variants that each of us inherit, than it is to actually understand the environmental influences. The genome is a closed space. With enough tech and with enough cash, we can actually do a good job of understanding what a person's inherited. The environment's more difficult.
Well, what are some of the environmental factors, or how sure are we that those environmental factors can play a part?
There's been a couple of decades of research into this, a lot of it coming from Scandinavian countries. And this very careful, large-scale work has identified a handful of things which appear to increase risk for schizophrenia. Family history, of course, is one that we've mentioned. Male sex is one. Exposure to marijuana at certain points in time can be a big one for some people. In addition, head trauma can be another one. And there's some other ones that have played in. Maternal infection when a child is in utero might also be one. One of the things that we're doing right now is we're actually teamed up with the people who are the world's experts in this, and we're trying to understand how genes and environment interact in order to influence risk of illness. That's really the next big thing.
And that's the vexing thing, right? Because what blend of a greater or lesser risk genetically and then exposure to one or more of these environmental variables, I would think that's a very difficult thing to test.
Absolutely. And we've identified that we can find people who have inherited very high risk of schizophrenia. Like if you look at the top 10 percentile, about a quarter of those individuals don't have schizophrenia. And the question is why? If you look at the lowest 10 percentile of genetic risk for schizophrenia, there's about 17% of the people in that group who do have schizophrenia. And the question again is why? So this, like all good science, we've learned some things, but a number of great questions have popped up.
It is great science, and it's good stuff that you're doing. There is, I suppose, a fear on the outside that now that we know this, somebody's going to develop a test and sell it, and that could have implications for people going forward depending on how they test. Given what you've said about how this doesn't determine that you're going to have schizophrenia, isn't there a bit of a risk that people could be stigmatized by, having these risk factors show up when, in fact, as you say, there's far more to it than that?
I'd like to be as absolutely crystal clear as I can. I do not think that there's a place for genetic testing at this point in time for schizophrenia. We said that in our paper as clearly as we could. You know, as you know, it may well be that somebody does market a test. This is not super well regulated in the United States and other countries right now, certainly not as well as it should be. But I don't think there's a good scientific background for it yet.
So what's next in testing and research?
So what we're doing right now is we've actually, even as we've published the largest ever study, we're doing a much, much larger one right now. So the Psychiatric Genomics Consortium, the consortium I lead, is now poised to increase markedly the sample size that we have for schizophrenia, as well as for bipolar disorder, major depression, anorexia, and a bunch of other disorders. So watch this space. We're hopeful that we'll have a lot more clarity in the next year or two.
And we'll have you back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Sullivan, a doctor at UNC School of Medicine, co-author of a breakthrough study about identifying genetic markers for schizophrenia. Just ahead, the hosts of the Dinner Party Download tell us how to be successful at social gatherings. You'll hear that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.